Deep in the heart of New York City's Museum of Natural History, behind the polished marble and gleaming display cases, something ancient and deadly has awakened. Imagine walking through those grand halls on a quiet afternoon, admiring prehistoric fossils and cultural artifacts, completely unaware that in the forgotten sub-basements below, a predator unlike anything modern science has documented is hunting. This is the chilling premise that made Relic a sensation, that had even Stephen King admitting it gave him nightmares. What makes this tale particularly unsettling isn't just the monster lurking in the shadows, it's how the horror emerges from plausible science rather than supernatural forces. The trouble begins with anthropologist Dr. Julian Whittlesey's ill-fated expedition to the Amazon. While searching for the mysterious Kothoga tribe, he discovers strange artifacts in unexplored caves, including a grotesque figurine called Mbun, he who walks on all fours. The expedition is plagued by disturbing incidents from the start. His fearless guides abandon him after muttering about ancient curses, animals are found mutilated, and the jungle falls unnaturally silent. When Whittlesey finds his colleague Crocker's body with the back of his skull surgically removed, scientific skepticism gives way to primal fear. In the undergrowth, slitted eyes the color of liquid fire watch him, accompanied by a sound unlike any known predator. The artifacts eventually make their way to New York, but something deadly travels with them, a presence that remains dormant until disturbed years later in the museum's sub-basements. What's so effective about this setup is how it plays on our instinctive fear of the unknown while grounding it in familiar settings. Haven't we all felt that momentary dread when venturing somewhere we shouldn't, sensing unseen eyes watching from the shadows? When bodies begin appearing in the museum, not just dead, but literally shredded, graduate student Margot Green and her mentor, Dr. Frock, find themselves piecing together a terrifying puzzle. An autopsy reveals a claw embedded in a victim's chest and evidence that the killer specifically targets the hypothalamus region of the brain. When analyzed, the claw shows a bizarre DNA mixture, part reptile, part primate, with many unidentifiable sequences. The scientific detective work reveals that crates from Whittlesey's expedition contained strange plant fibers with human hormones. The creature that escaped from those crates had been feeding on these hormone-rich fibers, and when its food supply was cut off, it began killing humans to extract their hypothalamus glands as a substitute. This biological imperative makes the horror more sophisticated. The creature isn't killing out of malice, but necessity, like an addict desperate for a fix. Dr. Frock's Callisto effect theory, that every 60 to 70 million years, a new predatory species emerges when life becomes too well adapted, provides a framework that makes the impossible seem disturbingly plausible. While a literal monster stalks the corridors, equally dangerous human monsters operate in the administrative offices. Public relations director Lavinia Reckman censors journalist Bill Smithback's manuscript about the museum's upcoming Superstition exhibition, demanding the removal of anything controversial or potentially embarrassing. Museum director Winston Wright and deputy director Ian Cuthbert orchestrate a sophisticated cover-up of disturbing incidents, including the disappearance of a young curator years earlier. When FBI Special Agent Pendergast implements necessary security protocols, Wright leverages his Washington connections to have him replaced with the more pliable Agent Coffey. Their singular focus on ensuring the exhibition opens on schedule reveals a chilling indifference to human cost. Isn't this the most relatable horror of all? How often do we see institutions prioritize reputation over safety, bureaucracy over humanity? These human antagonists represent institutional horror at its most insidious, the kind that operates through memos, meetings, and carefully worded press releases, where paperwork and politics prove as deadly as claws and fangs. Despite mounting evidence of danger, the Superstition exhibition opens as scheduled, filling the museum's great rotunda with New York's elite. Margot and Dr. Frock's warnings go unheeded. Warnings about a predator weighing 240 to 260 kilograms, capable of speeds up to 70 kph, with specialized adaptations for hunting by smell rather than sight. During the opening ceremony, a mutilated corpse falls into the crowd, triggering mass panic. The museum's sophisticated security system fails, plunging everything into darkness and automatically sealing the building into 5 isolated cells. The massive metal doors trap people inside with a creature that hunts by scent, navigates easily without light, and knows the museum's hidden passages better than those trying to escape. D'Agosta leads a group, including the mayor, through flooding sub-basement tunnels, creating a perfect pressure cooker of tension, monster, darkness, rising water, failing technology, with no good options available. The exhibition becomes a perfect storm, where hundreds of potential victims are trapped in darkness with a predator that thrives in precisely these conditions. As the crisis peaks, Special Agent Pendergast emerges as uniquely qualified to face the creature. Drawing from his experience hunting dangerous game in Africa, he understands that when facing a superior predator, the most effective strategy isn't attempting kill shots, but breaking down the animal by targeting its mobility. Pendergast and Margot initially try exploiting the creature's biological drives, using plant fibers it craves as bait. The beast demonstrates unexpected tactical awareness, avoiding their traps and setting counter-ambushes. This forces them to use themselves as living bait in a narrow corridor where Pendergast can maximize his shooting angles. The futility of conventional tactics becomes apparent when an elite SWAT team is systematically destroyed despite their state-of-the-art weapons. The climactic confrontation unfolds in the mineralogy wing, where Margot's scientific expertise proves decisive. Her understanding of primate anatomy allows her to identify a crucial vulnerability in the creature's forward-facing eyes, creating a direct channel to its brain cavity. This resolution masterfully synthesizes the novel's twin themes. The creature itself, a product of both evolution and human interference, is defeated through the combination of refined hunting instincts and scientific acumen. Months after the museum disaster, the survivors learn the creature's true nature through DNA analysis and Kawakita's research notes. The museum beast was actually Dr. John Whittlesey, transformed by an ancient reovirus preserved within the plant for 65 million years. The Kotoga tribe, desperate to protect their way of life, had force-fed Whittlesey the plant, turning him into Mboon, the guardian beast. This final revelation transforms the narrative from a monster story into a tragedy of human hubris. Whittlesey, driven by scientific curiosity, had crossed boundaries that ancient wisdom marked as forbidden. His transformation suggests that the line between humanity and monstrosity is far more fragile than modern science would have us believe. What makes Relic endure isn't just its pulse-pounding action, but how it challenges our understanding of evolution, institutional ethics, and the consequences of scientific arrogance. Next time you visit a natural history museum, you might find yourself glancing nervously at those basement doors, wondering what forgotten specimens might be stored beyond them, and whether some things were meant to remain undiscovered.